Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about, I would say, a shift in consciousness, an awakening of who we are, what is possible, the nature of reality, and I think the role of human beings as we interact with other beings. And tonight's guest has written a fascinating book about owls, when I have my own owl story, but it's called The Messengers, and it's Owl Synchronicities and the UFO Abductee. The guest is Mike Cleland, and the book is published by our good friend, Richard Dolan Press. So, Mike, thanks for being here tonight.
You're very welcome.
And your book is very well researched. I mean, there's stories after stories of these strange owl appearances and synchronicities with UFOs and mythic lore and shamanic possibilities. Can I just start off by telling you my owl story?
Oh, please do. I collect owl stories, and I relish every single one of them.
Well, this is one that I haven't. I mean, there's elements in the book of what I found, and I am an abductee. At least I think I am. Who knows? I mean, because it is in that strange dream type reality that these experiences happen. But I've had series my whole life of somehow strange interactions with beings and dreams, mostly in dream states. But anyway, this one doesn't. My story doesn't directly connect with ETs, but I'll tell you what it was. I was living in Hawaii at the time, in Maui, and on a friend's land, and it's just like big open land, but there was this little depression in the land, and there was a teepee in this like depression below like the surface of the road. So this was in 1989, and I think that was the first night I was sleeping. I had a series of very strange dreams where I was visiting, or they were visiting me, my dead relatives or relatives. Maybe they weren't all dead, but they did die soon or in the next couple of years. But so I was visiting them as if I was in this underworld, like visiting these dead relatives, or they were, I don't know, we were interacting. I was talking to them. I mean, it was as if they were dead, but they weren't. So anyway, that dream just really freaked me out. You know, it's like, wow, that's weird, because it was, you know, it's, I still remember that dream today. I mean, that was 1989. What is that now? Like 30 years later or something?
Getting close. So anyway, to 30 years, yeah.
Right. So the dream freaked me out so much that I got out of that kind of teepee type structure that I was in and walked up the embank to the road. And when I got to the road, it was still dark, but in front of me, I would say maybe 20 feet away, I saw this. It was like a vision. It was like a man with wings. This is what it looked like to me. And you know, if you see something that's so strange, you can't understand it, you just stare at it. Well, I was just staring at this looked like a man with wings flying off into the distance. And it was only later that I realized that must have been an owl, because, you know, they have that round head, and it was silhouetted against the night sky. So it probably was like some moonlight, but it was so strange. Like right after this dream of these dead relatives, I walk up the surface of this little encampment, and there's this silhouette of this owl flying off as if it was like leaving the scene of the dream. I mean, it was a real owl. I mean, that wasn't a screen memory, I don't think, but it was so strange, because just at first I could not make out what this was. It was looked like, you know, with its round head, and that's what, and wings flying off, and it must have been a huge barn owl, but I don't know. It still freaks me out somehow. And your book brought back that memory. I hadn't thought about that in a long time. So I mean, what do you make of that kind of sequence of events?
Well, this is exactly what I have been dealing with. I mean, on my own, I'm dealing with these kind of things with my own memories. I mean, the book is based on my own firsthand experiences. And it's also, I receive so many letters since the publication of this book. And even before it, I was kind of known as the owl guy. The word got out and I was doing this kind of research. And if you Google UFOs and owls, you know, my name is not only the first name that comes up, it's the next seven or eight things. So, you know, obviously there's no UFO in this story except in your life experience. And the owls, when I was writing the book, I must have typed the word UFO and owl, I don't know how many thousands of times. And I got them mixed up all the time, right? They're just three letter words. And I would type them backwards. And I just did it just now where I called an owl a UFO. But, So tied into the lore of the owl is a connection to the dead. And it's also a connection to other realms. And you said it straight up how you described it. You described it as this kind of underworld where you were meeting your relatives. And so, so the owl has a connection, you know, so an owl can see into the nighttime. So you go back to ancient man. I mean, even, you know, our furthest ancestors in the caves had to have recognized that the owl could see in the darkness, and that that same metaphor plays out today where they are seeing into a darkness, you know, becomes symbolic. They're seeing into another realm, and then they can travel to that other realm and come back with a message. So in a way they're the gatekeepers of the underworld, you know, if you had an experience with the dead, there's all kinds of owl lore with the dead, as well as there's a chapter in the book called Owls and Death where I talk about the modern present day reports I'm getting, which very much like what you just said there, but that owls, you know, so here we have the gatekeeper to the underworld. So you had an experience where perhaps, you know, on some metaphoric or symbolic level, you know, in your dream space, you entered that realm. You said it was a very vivid dream that you're remembering over 30 years later now, nearly 40 years later. Yeah. So that tells me something, you know, if someone has that kind of memory. So, yeah, so it's perfect. Tell you?
Right. I mean, it could be a story in your book, of course, because there's lots of stories.
Yeah, there's lots of stories just like that.
What does it tell you? I mean,
well, a couple things. It tells me that to take the memory of that dream seriously, as well as, now, honestly, you know, I've seen a lot of owls, and I spent a lot of time in the outdoors, and I recognize that I've seen owls in normal situations, and I've seen owls fly at night, and yes, it's jarring, and yes, they're beautiful birds, but and there's something awe-inspiring about seeing an owl, but that's not what you were describing just now. You were describing something to me, you know, it could have been a real owl, but it has a flavor of something more powerful. So that experience, you know, I'll never know, you know, whether it was a screen memory, whether it was some sort of implanted memory, whether it was a real owl, you know, but your reaction is important. So all I can really say, I don't have an answer what it means. All I can say is that take it seriously. Take the message that came in those dreams seriously. I don't know if you can remember specifically what the message was. I mean, just meeting, you know, relatives who had passed, or the way you said it, soon to have would pass. You know, just take that very seriously. This is, I think these doors are open, and we have to, you know, wrestle with two different shamans could have the same visionary experience, and they could be very, very gifted shamans, and they might decipher the symbology of these things differently. So I don't have an answer to what it is. All I can say is, you know, pay attention.
Well, it seems like, I mean, as you're talking, in a sense, you sort of have become a shaman yourself in the process of writing this book, and what they would say is having owl medicine is what the natives would say. Does that sound like it's true?
I've actually wrestled with this a little bit, but it's being a shaman, right? That's like, you know, if you're like a brain surgeon, right? You go to a university, you get your degree in brain surgery, and then you become a, you know, doctor of brain surgery. You get anointed somehow a shaman. At the same time, I think people can stumble into these realms and then perform a shamanic like service. So yeah, so I see what you're saying and I agree with it, but I would say no, I'm not a shaman, but I would say that in a way I'm with this book offering a shamanic like storybook, I guess.
I think you are, I mean, in a sense, a shaman. Maybe you're not doing the shamanic. It's what I get, because I studied with lots of different shamans, different traditions. It is a shamanic sort of journey. I mean, you have the whole UFO thing, which is its own sort of shamanic understanding. But what I get from this book is that you are making a strong case for the mystery, in a sense, that's all around us.
Oh, very much so.
Owls are the guardians of that mystery. I mean, they're strange creatures. I mean, but what do you, I mean, it's no coincidence that they keep showing up. I mean, do you get from all your research that somehow they're tuned into these psychic type spaces, and that there really are dimensional doorways, let's say, that they're guardians of?
I see where you're going with this, but I don't really know if that's the case. In a strange way, the best way that I can put it is that the, you know, let's say that the chess master of reality, you know, they've organized the grand chessboard and they're moving the pieces around. You know, I would think that they would just at the precise moment set the owl chess piece in front of the observer at just the right moment. So I think it's less that the owl is the guardian of a gate, and more that the owl makes a symbolic appearance when is necessary. How that happens, you know, the stage manager of reality has written it into the script that an owl will make its appearance in the theatrical narrative of someone's life at these precise moments. That to me plays out a little cleaner than an owl standing like a century at a gate somewhere.
I see. Well, so that kind of gets more towards the alien visitor manipulation of reality type of theme, right? Is that what you're getting at there?
I think so. Yeah. And at the same time, you know, is it truly an alien? Because so you know, people who have are studying shamanism. People in the throes of shamanic initiation will have owl experiences. People at certain points in meditation will have owl experiences. People who have had someone recently die, a close friend, a relative, will have owl experiences. People on mushrooms, people taking psychedelic drugs, often in sort of a shamanic, you know, journeying aspect, but people, you know, will have owl experience. So I would consider all these things, meditation, shamanic initiation, psychedelic trip, you know, and death. These are transformational experiences. And with these, this is where the owl shows up. So it's less that it's directly tied in to the UFO thing, which I'm certain it is, but it's more that the UFO thing is tied into a transformational experience on the part of the observer.
Right. And that also gets into what people, who's the guy who wrote the Omega Point, that talk about near-death experiences.
Yeah, yeah, Kenneth Ring, yeah.
Kenneth Ring, and also they're doing a lot of that work with the Free organization.
And I'm working on a second book now where I'm just kind of keeping a little checklist, you know, that the people I'm interviewing, how many people have had a near-death experience. You know, this is curious. I haven't found the direct connection. It might be out there, but I just have not gotten a story or any number of stories connecting the near-death experience to an owl. I certainly have the death experience. People who die have had owl experiences. And then people who have died come back and have also had UFO experiences. Those people have had owl experiences, but not, I don't have any direct links that seem to be intertwined with a near-death experience, which is surprising to me. I just expect it, but it's not so.
You should talk to Ray Hernandez. He's been doing.
Oh, I know him well. Know, yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay. He hasn't come up with any story either, huh?
No, but he's come up with a lot of good research on exactly, you know, on the fact that there's this abnormality in the population. So people who claim direct UFO contact also claim having had a near-death experience at a higher percentage than what would be the statistical norm.
Right, but you're not seeing any correlation between near-death and owls. That's what you're saying. There's none of that.
No, but I am seeing people who have had near-death and UFO experiences certainly are having owl experiences. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Well, I mean, it all points to there's a greater reality. Did you read Whitley Strieber's last book, Supernatural?
I read most of it, yeah. And I, you know, what I did is I went through the index and read all the owl parts. There's tons of owl stuff in there. And then it's interesting that that book came out.
Yes.
Oh, that book came out like within just a few weeks of my book. And they both have an owl eyes, big bright yellow eyes
on the cover.
Yeah.
Yes, because owl was one of the things you read about that in this book, one of the first things he associated with his visitors. So, but what I'm getting to is that in that book, he says what we've been calling aliens, ETs, visitors, may not be what they really are. They may be just, that may just be a word or label that we use to describe something that's unfathomable. Do you go along with that?
Yeah, and that shows up right in the book. I state it very clearly. You know, I stay in the framework, and I use the term, I know Whitley uses the term visitor, and as opposed to the term alien. And somewhere in the book, I think I say, I have the Webster's definition of alien. There's a number of them. One of them is, you know, someone from outer space. But another definition for alien is something that is so different as to be unknowable. And I think that's a safe, good definition for alien. So, but I agree, you know, but at the same time, like, you know, I don't think the Greek gods were gods in the way, you know, there were the togas and living on Mount Olympus and all that. I suspect if you hike to the top of Mount Olympus, there would be nothing there except some gravel and such. But I think it's good to be familiar with the narrative of the mythology. So yes, so I do say, you know, I talk about, you know, flying saucers and aliens and such like that. But you know, I also wrestle with the fact that when you look really closely at the big pool of data, as opposed to just selecting things, you know, the ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, sort of crumbles because it's just too weird. Now, I will say that I was cherry picking the data. I mean, I was only looking at owl related stories for this. So yeah, so I'm guilty of cherry picking the data. But within this pool of owl stories, some of the stuff is just too weird to be, in my opinion, you know, evidence of little beings coming here on a flying saucer from another planet. It's just too strange.
It's too strange, but, you know, we don't have to, but our mind wants to make up a story about, I mean, wants to, well, that's a nice story. They come here from another planet and they're abducting people. And
sure.
We can almost make sense of that, you know, with that, of course, it's weird, but
you can also make sense of, you know, the Greek gods living on Mount Olympus with their little togas, you know, and their you know, harps and, you know, throwing lightning bolts down on the mere mortals and such. Yeah. So, I can wrap my mind around that too.
Well, let me tell you my favorite quote. I'm sure you know it, by Terence McKenna, that about the whole thing. He says, "We are part of a symbiotic relationship with something which disguises itself as an extraterrestrial invasion so as not to alarm us."
Yeah. I mean, what is it, you know, what I think that the psychic overload that we'd be confronted with if we actually could fully understand. I don't think we're actually capable of fully understanding what is going on behind the veil. I think we're only just guessing at it. And that book, you know, the Big Owl book is nearly 400 pages of me, you know, mostly telling stories and peppering those stories with some speculation. And I try to keep the speculation at a minimum. I go a little overboard at times, but so, you know, like the stories stand alone. And I think we need to speculate a little bit. And I tried to keep it, you know, as sparse as I could. But yeah,
it's okay to speculate. People want your speculation because you're an expert, you're a researcher. They want to know, well, what do you make of all this? Because obviously, you know, it's our compulsion to create stories about our stories and define them. I mean, not that we have to believe them, but, you know. So your conclusion then is what, though, about the UFO alien reality connection? I mean, what if you could make it up, what would you say is really going on?
Well, the most honest answer would be I don't know. And then I would speculate, you know, like I could guess. So that my sense is that these owls are showing up as a sort of totem, as a sort of symbol. Like they're showing up symbolically as a, you know, like when you write a sentence and you want some oomph in your sentence, you put an exclamation point at the end of the sentence. And I feel like the owls in some way are like an exclamation point in reality. You know, you'll have this powerful experience seeing a UFO, and then an owl will show up, you know, punctuating the sentence. And if they represent anything, they seem to represent the, like the totem of the transformational process. You know, in the culmination of the book, I actually say I see them as alarm clocks, right? So an owl is there to do what an alarm clock does, is to wake you up. And I sense that people, and owls are interesting. It's not like seeing a bunny or even a big other, you know, profound bird. An eagle, you know, is a very majestic, large bird, but it does not have the same power that an owl has, the same sort of mysterious presence that an owl has.
Mm. Actually, I think you just helped me answer my thing about that story. I told you, for me, that vision of an owl was a kind of punctuation of that experience. I mean, I don't know what that means, but it was like, boom, maybe that experience was real and this is evidence of that or something.
Well, I cannot tell you how many accounts I have of people, you know, having a powerful dream or asking a question aloud, you know, like literally asking, you know, like, oh my gosh, am I an abductee? Is this true? You know, like they're wrestling. And at that moment, you know, an owl will hoot out the window, you know, at that very moment, you know, I have an account of someone, it's not in the book, it's actually in a separate account. It's just collected since the book has come out. You know, someone is acquired a Whitley Strieber's book. I think it's Transformation. He talks a lot about owls in that book too. And this person is reading about owls and UFOs. And he's like, oh my God, can this be real? Is there really a connection between owls and UFOs? And at that moment, his wife, you know, says, you know, John, come up from the basement. You know, I got to show you something. And there on the porch, staring at them through the front door is an owl.
Wow, that is a great, great story. Wow, thank you for that. So, I mean, all this, your book, Whitley's book, Supernatural, the ET Experience, for me, it suggests, and you sort of said it, that there's a level of reality that we're a part of somehow that we can't really comprehend. But I think sort of timeline that we're moving into, especially since this election, which was so bizarre, right?
I mean, I agree. Like I agree. It's truth is stranger than fiction. It feels like I'm living in a, you know, Philip K. Dick novel.
Exactly. And it's also like a reality show. What's the guy going to say next? I mean, what's the next adventure? So it's something has gotten really weird. And in a way, I was very disappointed, not because I liked Hillary Clinton so much, but I thought they were really close to disclosure. I mean, you know, poor Steve Bassett was just like drooling for it. And, you know,
I wasn't holding my breath. Yeah.
Really, I was, because it's like there was television shows and, you know, reports and leaked emails. We were so close. So are you not thinking that disclosure is something that will happen, or
you know, I'm at the point now, you know, with my own experiences and having seen what I've seen and experienced. I mean, I've seen a handful of UFOs. I mean, I feel absolutely, you know, unequivocal that, you know, what I've seen is would be categorized as, you know, a UFO, not some, you know, government test flight of something. So I don't need anyone. So I'm out of the loop, right? What do I care? No one needs to, I don't need anyone to disclose anything for me. So I'm, you know, all I can do is the hard work, you know, and so I don't need it. And not, you know, whether the society needs it,
it makes easier to, I mean, in a sense where, you know, people say, oh my God, yeah, let's read all these. But with the government comes out and says, guess what? You know, we have company. I think it makes our job a little easier. Don't you?
I don't know. I mean, I think there's going to be mayhem in the aftermath of that announcement. You know, I don't foresee the announcement taking place, you know, with a, you know, an official person like the president at a podium, you know. I think that, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how it's going to play out. So,
right, but it seems like it just was put to sleep. I mean, it seemed like, I mean, that was the disappointment. But what I meant is to say, I got off on that disclosure thing. What I meant to say is that reality is so strange that, and it's getting stranger, that I think we are realizing, hopefully, that something else is going on here. I think it's you know, a scientist, the mainstream science, tries to put it into neat little bundles of like, yeah, they know there's this other layer of awakening, that we are connected to something bigger, that the human being, and because we're connected to the conscious flow of the universe, is not what we've been told by religions and governments and media. There's an awakening on the mass conscious level. That's what I feel. Do you get a sense of that?
I feel that too. And the way I see it, in a sense, is that, you know, Whitley Strieber came out with that book 30 years ago, Communion, right? So that around 30 years ago. And that's over a quarter century ago. And he was vilified. He was raked over the coals. He was just dismissed with contempt and laughed at, and the derision and the humiliation. I came out.
It's also a bestseller. And also, like you say, but it's also been said other places, a quarter million people wrote to him saying, thank you, this is like my experience. So, yeah.
Oh, I agree. There's two things happening. Yeah. Simultaneously. And, you know, he's getting thanked and condemned, you know.
Yeah.
But what I've found, and I've talked to other people who've sort of come out with their experiences in the last few years, there's just very little of that, you know, like, I mean, almost none. I mean, I've had so little. I'm sure people have said things behind my back, but never, no one's ever said anything mean to my face. People have questioned and asked me what I realize is genuine questions, you know, like they're curious what I'm trying to, you know. So that in 30 years, that's a huge change. I mean, I'm not a best-selling author, so I wasn't like in the limelight like Whitley Strieber was. But that is a powerful, huge change in the mindset. And I just see that it won't take very much, you know, it's not going to take another 30 years before, you know, that softens up even more, and people just recognize that this is undeniably true.
Right, right. No, I agree. I mean, alien abduction, whatever it actually is a household word. Everyone has heard that expression.
Oh, everyone has absolutely. Everyone has the, you know, the, you know, it might be sensationalized. They might have gotten it from a late night TV documentary, but everyone knows about the bright light coming through the bedroom window and the aliens standing around the bed and being lifted off the bed and taken into the craft and the medical exams. Everyone.
I know, but that's fascinating that now it's in the collective psyche.
It is fascinating. I agree. Yeah.
I mean, it's even in the New Yorker magazine. Do you ever read New Yorker magazine?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You want to hear my favorite abduction joke?
Sure.
It's typical American baseball cap, beer belly. He's on what looks like a ship, and next to him are two little aliens. But this guy's like looking around, wondering what happened. You abducted him. You feed him.
Oh, like the puppy. Like bringing the puppy home.
You feed him like you're like a dog. You abducted him, so you feed him.
Yeah.
You know, well, I thought it was funny.
You dropped out just a tiny bit in there, so I think I got most of it, though.
No, one alien says the other, so you abducted him, so you feed him.
Like, sure, you know, yeah. Bringing the puppy home.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm just using that to understand, like, wow, even have a joke like that means like there's a sense, and maybe it is this subconscious awareness that has to happen first. Whitley sort of implies that in order for the reality or the acknowledgement to come forward, I think without these levels of pop culture understanding it, then there's no way for it to actually show up in the culture at some point, right?
I think if you were going to introduce it and you had a long-term plan, this is exactly how you would want to do it. And maybe it's like the government's long-term plan, or maybe it's, the aliens' long-term plan, or what the others, or the visitors, or whatever term you want to use. You know, yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Experiences. I know we're getting away from our experience. What are these experiences? What did you realize about yourself and the contact experience?
Well, I mean, initially, I thought I was going crazy. I mean, I spent 5 years maybe just like not being able to make sense of it. It felt like the tape loop had ground, was stuck in the groove and wouldn't jump out, where it was just these same questions over and over again. Did this really happen? Could it be real? Is it really happening? You know, why me? You know, I mean, exactly the questions you would expect, but it really disrupted my life.
Can you relate one of those stories? Like, but can you tell us, I mean, now that you've integrated it, can you tell us like the detail if you care to? I mean, I know it's in the book, but do you mind?
So here's one that I'll just, I had a handful of experiences growing up. I had a missing time event when I was 12, that was associated with a bright light in the sky. And I came home late and my parents were angry at me for being out late. Later, one of the kids that I was with, I was 12 years old. It would have been 1974. You'll get this. You'll know this. It was 1974 and I wanted to be home in time to see a television show. And I was home an hour too late. Well, over an hour too late. It might have been as closer to 2 hours too late to see the show. And my parents were angry at me. Why are you out so late? And I was like, what are you mad at me for? I'm home well in time to see this show. And the show is Kolchak the Night Stalker.
Oh.
Which I'm assuming you must remember. You're about the right age to have seen that when it was out.
Yeah, I think I don't think I saw much of that, but yeah. So that was a favorite show of yours, huh? Yeah.
And it was also a favorite show. It was like supposedly the reason that Chris Carter created the X-Files was because he loved that show so much. So that happened, and then I have another account of seeing a close-up UFO around that same time.
But what was the part that was so hard to believe that thought you were going crazy about? What was that part?
You know, honestly, so here, let me just tell you. So there's one story, and then living in Maine, this would have been the winter of 92, 93, and I woke up in the middle of the night. I was alone in the house woke up in the middle of the night, and the way the bed was kind of pushed up against a window. So all I had to do is just kind of sit up just a tiny bit, and I could look right out the window. And there's a bright light coming through the window, and I sit up and look outside, and there's five, like, classic spindly gray aliens walking towards the house. And they're backlit by this bright, bright light. And I should have freaked out, right? I should have freaked out and run away and locked the doors and, you know, grabbed a baseball bat or whatever. You know, I should have panicked, but I didn't. It felt like I had a voice in my head, and the voice very quietly said, "Oh yes, they're here. Now is the time to put your head on the pillow and shut down." And that's exactly what I did. And I didn't even bother to go out and look the next morning to see if there were footprints in the snow. And there was a handful of other things associated with this event. One of the things was it was so hyper vivid. It was so eerily, eerily real, but not real in like a clarity of everyday thought. This was something deeper. And I recognized that this was, you know, I understood this thing. So there's been a handful of experiences since then where I've had that hyper real same sense, and it's palpable. I can recognize it. I know what it feels like. It's tangible. So when it happened again, I knew it right in the moment. And it happened one time when I was in a tent and I was, woke up in the middle of the night and had this profound sense of fear. And me and the other person that were in the tent was just like, we were both panicking. And then with a snap of a finger, we both fell asleep. And then it seemed like the next thing I remember was I was lifting up. I had this elevator up feeling, lifted up through the top of the tent. And there's a lot to that story. So these are the accounts that were saying, you know, am I crazy? And I will also say that what happened was in 2006, which is, it's almost 2017. So this is, it'll be 11 years ago. So 10 years. So this is sort of I'm in the 10th year now of an event that took place where I was seeing lots of owls, like so many owls. And every time I would see them in the moment, I would have this knowing, this sense, this voice was just like, this has something to do with UFOs. And I was wrestling with it. I was struggling with it. And the owls, seeing all these owls starting in 2006 to around 2010 or 11, all these owls kind of forced me to look into my own experiences, which I had denied. I mean, I just told you the missing time thing and then the beings out the window. Like, I just said, no way, didn't happen. I just got things confused. So, you know, that was the my worry.
Your worry that you were crazy.
Yeah. That I was crazy. Yeah. That I had lost my mind. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, even John Max says, lots of people say that that's a common feature of the abductee experience, and that, yeah, you think this can't be real because as John Max says, this is what he labeled ontological shock, the shock that reality is not what we've been told it is. That is probably the single most traumatic part of the contact abduction experience. That
I agree. I mean, so you have a moment of, you know, utter bewilderment or terror or you know, wonder or whatever the emotional event. And then you have to, you know, then your reality crumbles, right? You were taught about reality in junior high school and, you know, by your parents and everything and the New York Times. And then, you know, all of a sudden your direct experience says, no, that is not how reality is. Reality is something entirely different.
Right. So I think this, and when I referenced the election, I think this is the turning point we are at, in a large-scale way. I mean, you know, at this moment in history, that we are seeing reality is not what we thought it was. I mean, I think someone like Donald Trump is an exaggeration of that, but it's a reality. You know, it's like, how could that be? How could this? How could some, you know, television reality show guy actually be president? It doesn't make any sense. You know, it's like,
yeah, except that it happened. Yeah,
exactly. So it's like, it doesn't make any sense that we've been taken aboard these ships and, you know, taken genetic samples. It doesn't make any sense except that it happened. There's no, so I think we are being called on now by maybe the ETs, whoever they are, to realize that reality is nothing. That's actually why I call my program New Realities, because I speak and do maybe to my contact experiences that reality is not what we've been told it need to create. And I think that's what you're doing with your book, is creating, along with many other people, the foundation for a larger worldview.
Well, I didn't set out to write that into the book, but that's in it. I mean, that's kind of, you know, what I was wrestling with. I mean, writing a book I didn't have a little outline when I started. I just started writing, and by the end, that's what it, you know, I definitely wrestle with exactly that, what you're saying there. Yeah. There's something grander at play than what we can perceive. And that I think that all of us can tap into it on some level. It's different for every person. I think this thing tailors itself to the individual somehow. And you know, we're given clues, we're given synchronicities, we're given, you know, symbolic events along the path of our lives.
I mean, synchronicity itself is a sign that reality is not what we have been taught, right?
I mean, absolutely, and it's also something that all of us on one level experience. I think some people more than others, and all of us manage to somehow dismiss it and just sort of chug along with, like, you know, the daily grind.
Well, some people do. I try to really pay attention even if I'm reading a word and then the television's on, it's like, boom, the same word is, I mean, of course it could be a coincidence, but what's a coincidence? But I try to take notice of those synchronicities and even watching the way birds fly and certain moments, I just try to see what's the universe saying at this point. But I mean,
I agree. And I do too. And at the same time, yes. You know, you gotta, whatever, you gotta put your pants on one leg at a time, you know?
That's funny. Yes. Yes, yes. But I think no one's really been able to formulate. I mean, there have been pioneers taking stabs at this new level of reality. I mean, Whitley is John Mack. I mean, that book, Abductions by John Mack, and even Passport to the Cosmos is a stab at these next level of possibilities. But it hasn't been bridged yet. I mean, of course, there's a whole ayahuasca cult that's rising on the East Coast and West Coast that I think is helping to formulate or understand these levels. But I don't think we need those things, because it's weird enough as it is, you know?
I mean, I agree. I think that, you know, having ayahuasca is sort of like, you know, getting kicked a little further down the field, you know, than you would if you had to, you know, get to that same point through meditation or through contemplative, you know, research or something like that. I think you get a big jump start with ayahuasca. I've never taken ayahuasca, so I'm just saying from what I've heard.
I mean, I've taken it. I don't think it's not as intense as the UFO experience. It's definitely not as intense as some healing experiences, like being around John of God. You definitely go into an altered state. You know who that is, John of God?
I've heard of him, yes.
He's a medium. He goes into a state. People have incredible healings. Even if you don't need to heal something, you're in this, or at least I am. And then people I were with, too, said, wow, this is the highest or most altered they've, in a sense, ever been, was being in this presence. And Well, that's another point I wanted to address in that you bring out in the book about the Oz factor, Jenny Randall, and that, you know, the presence of these beings shifts our reality. And do you have any idea why that would be? I have my own ideas, but I'm interested in what you have to say.
Well, I have a few. I mean, so what I described earlier, that event in the winter of 92, 93, where I woke up in the middle of the night, looked out the window at the bright light and the beings out there, I described this, you know, weird hypervividness, and that's what it was. I mean, that it matches the Oz factor so clearly, and I've had it four other times. So clearly and vividly. It's unmistakable when you have it again, right? So you've had it once, it's got a flavor to it. It's not just some sort of ambiguous fog. It is palpable and defined. I spoke to this one woman about her experiences, and I don't think I prompted her. It's a question I ask, is how would you describe, you know, any of the being in the presence of this? And I want to hear other people's description of exactly this Oz factor. And she said something that was so perfect for me. She said, you know how when you take two magnets, right, and you get the north and south ends, and then they click together and they lock together in one direction, but you switch one of the magnets around and try to push them together, and suddenly they are repelling each other, and there's this kind of warbly kind of pressure, this kind of undulating, you know, sense, you know, it's this invisible thing between the two magnets, but you can feel it. She said, when I was in the presence of that UFO, it was like being in between those magnets. Mm. And I knew instantly that I'm like, oh my God, like she's speaking her truth and I get it to my core. That's a perfect definition. So I don't know the source of it.
Is it like, my experience has been less conscious, but would you say it's a hyper consciousness, a hyper realism in a sense
a hyper realism in the sense that
presence
in the sense that from my experiences things become a little more clear, things become a little more vivid. You know, there's reports in UFO accounts of people who get taken aboard flying saucers, right, and they leave their glasses, right, down there on the glasses are on their nightstand, but they can see perfectly. And then so, you know, then that they struggle, like, what happened, you know, why would I be able to see clearly? So I don't have an answer to what that might mean, but there is a vividness to this. And my sense is that there's, I'll just say, a field, like a field of energy that surrounds, let's just say, the craft itself, you know, the physical proximity of the craft may produce this distorted reality. That's probably a simple, maybe too simple of a speculation, but that's how it feels.
No, but that's in Whitley's book. That's the whole Condon report. Linda Moulton Howe talks about that. They talk about the plasma fields distorting neurological perceptions. Do you know about that?
Oh, yeah. I don't know that exact thing, but that's distorting neurological perceptions. Sure, yeah. Well, and that's one thing I speculate in the book is that if a craft can do this, you know, perhaps the one animal uniquely, you know, prepared to see or hear these craft would be the owl. I mean, the owl have what amounts to by far the best hearing of any, you know, animal, and also what might be the best night vision of any animal. So they have these highly attuned eyes, these highly attuned ears. And they, you know, so what are they seeing? What are they hearing? You know, are they showing up at the time of a UFO sighting simply like a giant dog whistle? You know, they're attracted to it? I don't know.
Well, one more thing I want to say about this field effect. I think you're right. I think there is maybe plasma, or maybe because it's maybe from another dimension. But there's also something about the ETs themselves that seem to generate a conscious feel that, for me, it's hard to stay present. It's like their, this is just my sense, their reality, their sense of reality, their sense of consciousness itself is so much larger or maybe more powerful that it distorts our perception on the level that we are conscious. So it's, that was my summation of why it's hard to stay aware in their presence, why most people have missing time because it's so distorted, the field.
I've heard many accounts that would what you just said there would fits very cleanly. Sure.
Do you think the abductions scenario has lessened over the years? It seems to me it has. What do you get? Because you've done a lot of research.
Well, I don't think it's gone to zero. I think there was a high point in the 70s, 80s, and early 90s. There's a great big upswing in the bell curve. And that's when, you know, the tail end of that is when Whitley was getting all those letters. That was when Bud Hopkins, you know, started publishing his books. But it's still going on. Just from what people are saying, I think the flavor of it has changed somewhat. So it seems to be like an evolving thing. Are they being the aliens, are they following an agenda, right? Do they have a big, you know, clipboard that says, you know, on this date we'll perform these duties, experiments, you know, and then they're just following a calendar of duties. I don't know what it is, but my sense is, yes, it's still going on, but it has changed. It has certainly lessened in my sense from the, you know, the busy time of the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I agree. My guess, and there's no way of proving it, is that, and from what other people, that they were here, at least the Grays were, because I'm sure there's many types for the genetic information and getting hybrid rice that is not going to take over the planet, but they wanted our genetics and their genetics to mix, maybe to preserve both races. And I think those experiments have, it's just my feeling and who knows, have concluded to some degree, and this population of beings that they were incubating have now, you know, matured and gone maybe to another planet. I mean, this is what Bashar says. He's the offspring of that. But
sure, and I've heard as much too. Yeah. So,
but of course, there's no way of knowing. But maybe, who knows? Someday it may all come out, or, you know, or it may not. You know, there's been great people who never knew the answer to those questions. But getting back to the owl itself, have you, because, you know, owls are mysterious creatures. Do you get the sense? Have you spent a lot of times with owls in captivity? Do you get a sense of their intelligence at all? Talk about that.
You know, I don't really have a good way to talk about their intelligence. You know, there's a bunch of books. There's a book called Wesley the Owl. And then there's another book called The Owl Who Likes to Sit on Caesar. And both of those are like people who like had a pet owl. And they talk about how wonderful it is and how like loving these owls. And I think they're both, one's a tawny owl and one's a barn owl. And, you know, I think that they're not as intelligent as parrots. I mean, they're kind of, I don't want to say simple, that's, you know, but, you know, I just heard a story of the woman who worked at the Raptor Center in a town where I used to live. You know, she was the only person who could handle the owl. No one else could handle the owl because the owl would kind of freak out, you know? And so she cut her hair one day and came in and went to grab the owl, and the owl freaked out. So the owl couldn't recognize her, you know, it was just, she had a different haircut and the owl perceived it was something different. So, So owls are, they're certainly, they may not be the smartest of all birds in that realm, where, I mean, ravens and parrots are certainly smarter in my sense, just from the little minimal research I've done. But they certainly are the most highly attuned as far as hearing and vision, especially night vision.
Are they the only birds that have frontal vision? Because most birds have eyes to the side.
You know, I'm not sure. I should be very careful saying only, but I know that they certainly are the one major, you know, species of birds, or, you know, within the avian, you know, realm, the family. And they, So they are, they have their eyes up front. So they hunt differently than a hawk would hunt, or hunt differently than an eagle would hunt. And owls can be very tiny, little teeny owls. There's little 6-inch tall owls, you know, so they get, you know, there's the, most of the owls are actually very small and do not make the low mournful hooting that we associated with the big owls. And we never see them because they come out at night, right? So you'll never see, you know, people can live in the forest for their whole lives and never see a saw-whet owl or an elf owl.
Huh. How many different types of owls are there?
You know, I have no idea. It's I'm not sure. I mean, you know, that you look on, I mean, in North American owls, right? You look at the owl book and there's a few pages. So it's not, you know, there's other birds that have, they're more ducks, I think, than there are owls, different kinds of ducks.
There's owls on Europe, and every continent has owls, would you say?
Not Antarctica, but yeah, so.
Oh, I see. And in most of the indigenous cultures, they do have a similar sort of role?
A certain similar thread. I mean, so the difference would be that whether they're seen as something dark and evil, right? So the Africa has a lot of owl mythology that's kind of threatening and foreboding, as well as the Southwest Indians in the United States have a real ominous mythology of the owls. But other places don't, you know, the Scandinavia and, you know, Greece and parts of Europe have a very, very, you know, they do represent death in most of those cultures, but not in like a dark, foreboding negative way. That was something I was sort of surprised with. You know, I found a lot of stories associating owls with death, and none of them seemed to be, I'll say, negative. They weren't dark stories. They were very uplifting, powerful stories.
Huh. Well, so do you feel, though, in writing this book, you were almost directed to do? I mean, it's the impression I got.
That's the impression I got, too. Like, it didn't sort of play out that way until I had sort of, you know, gotten to the, you know, finished the book in a way. It was like, how did I do this? How did it happen? And the level of synchronicity, like I'd have a, you know, like I'd have a chapter and then be just like, well, it just needs this one story. The chapter's really not coming together. And I just need one story. And then ping, you know, the email would come in and it would be the perfect story. And I would like go, well, there it is. That's solved. And that happened so many times in so cleanly that I just kind of abandoned myself to the writing process and allowed it to happen. And it was a really powerful, streamlined experience. I mean, I had to grit my teeth and actually do the hard work of writing it and everything like that. But, you know, I almost did no research in the formal way. Things simply landed in my lap.
Wow. And you've collected so many amazing stories there.
And there's, I mean, it just, it's good. It's, I mean, that book is, you know, the tip of the iceberg. And since the book has come out, like, I can't keep up with it. My partner, Andrea, is just like, you know, I mean, it's, she's like, okay, what happened? What came in today? You know, what new story did you get? And I'm like, oh my God, I got these three and this new story and this thing and this person, I got to get back to them. And it relates to something else. And, you know, now I got to try to put these two puzzle pieces together that I never thought of. And so, yeah, it's just, I'm grateful. It's exciting. But at the same time, I just feel a little overwhelmed at times.
What are you going to do with, you said you're writing another book about something?
Well, the follow-up book is, you know, when I finish the big owl book, I mean, that book is almost 400 pages. I'm sitting on the desk here holding it in my hand right now. And it's bigger than it should be, right? So I shouldn't have made a book that big and fat. And I did, but I think it's all valid and I'm glad I put it all in there. But I was going to add even more and it just didn't, there was no way to fit it in. So there's, this follow-up book is, most of these accounts were touched on during my research of the book, and I just had to push them aside and come back later. And so this follow-up book will read like a book of short stories, I'm sensing. You know, it'll be a little under 200 pages approximately. That's my guess right now. And just one story after another. And what it allows in this format would be to just tell the stories more completely. In the book, I had to kind of, which I felt terrible about doing, I had to really edit down and trim down the accounts.
Well, if you want to use my story, you can.
Yeah. No, I should. I'll. What I may do is get to call you back and do like a formal interview and just get the exact what you really, you know, remember on each. So
yeah, I'd love that, because it was, like I said, very connected to my dream, and just seeing an owl flying was, I'm living in New York City. Where do you ever see an owl here? But I was visiting Hawaii, and boom, there was this thing that I've
well,
never
and living
seen.
In a you're like sleeping in a traditional teepee, you know, you're in a round structure, you know, like, I mean, that's the UFO, right? You were in a round structure.
Yes. Interesting. Huh. Well, sort of sum it up, put it all together, what do you make of these owl synchronicities, UFOs, abductees? I mean, what do you want people to take away from reading this book?
Well, yeah, that's a big question. In one sense, you know, when I stepped into the writing of the book, I didn't really have an agenda, right? You know, like, I just let the stories accumulate, and I just kind of tried to decipher them and try to, you know, cluster the similar stories together in chapters. So that was all real formal and such. So that was, you know, that was kind of busy work. But what happened in review of the whole book, there's certainly some dark stories in the book, and people have had dark experiences. But the overwhelming amount, you know, that's a small percentage. The overwhelming takeaway is that these owls, well, let's, I mean, just put the people who tell the owl stories, right? There's lots of people who tell UFO stories, but the people who tell UFO and owl stories seem to be on a more spiritual path. I mean, spiritual path is a very open-ended term.
No,
you know?
No, it's true. It's true. I get what you're saying, but so
yeah. What? Like Reiki, the number of people who are Reiki therapists. It's just, I cannot put it in. I mean, how the percentage of the people that are Reiki therapists who've had UFO experiences and owl experiences, is statistically, I'm going to say 50%. And it might even be higher than that.
I've studied Reiki myself. You could put me in that category.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. So there's,
do you feel though, I mean, we talked about this a little bit before, that this the consciousness of people are changing somehow through these awarenesses?
Well, the individuals who've had these experiences, yeah, their consciousness has been changed. Their lives have been changed. Their outlook has been changed. You know, they'll say straight up, like, I had a spiritual awakening, or I had a kundalini opening, or I had a, you know, I changed my life path, you know? So people will say that straight up, and they'll say it was connected to the owl, connected to the UFO. So, you know, as a thought experiment entering into these waters, I treated, you know, owls, synchronicities, and UFOs all as the same thing. Well, obviously they are not the same thing, but they do have the same transformational power. So it's easy, right? You have a powerful synchronicity, like, ooh, that can change your life, right? You know, so like, oh my God, I had this really powerful synchronicity. I made a decision to change my life at that point, and it's been rewarding for me to do that, right? So that you can see that, right? Someone has a close-up UFO encounter. Oh, their life has changed, right? You can see that too. But I've also had people say that they've had these owl experiences. They've seen an owl. This doesn't sound like a very exciting story, right? They see an owl, and then somehow their life has changed. I'm sure other people have seen eagles or other mythic animals, wolves or something like that, and it's been had a profound sense. But so, you know, all of these things, owls, synchronicities, and UFOs have the power to be transformative. When they all happen together, you know, the three of them in the lives of people like abductees, you know, these people are set on a completely alternate path than Joe Normal would be.
Right.
But, you know, so yeah, but I, you know, and obviously people, Joe Normal can step out of his path and do profound things, without an owl, a UFO or a powerful synchronicity. But, yeah. So the owls seem to, I guess, be signposts along the life journey for someone on a journey that's taken them far afield from what society wants people to be on.
Yeah, no, it's true. Did you relate it all to the way the ancient Egyptians would sort of have archetype animals as the signposts of other types of parts of the psyche, I would guess, is one way of putting
it. I did. There's a whole chapter on archetypes in there, yeah. So there's a woman that I spoke with. Her name is, you may have met her. She shows up at conferences. Her name is Jacqueline Smith, and she's not the Charlie's Angels from the 70s. Same name, different spelling. So Jacqueline Smith. She wrote a book on animal communication, and she also channeled this other book, and she channeled it spirit by spirit from these animal spirits. And one of the animal spirits was an owl. And I read this book and I was like, oh my gosh, I got to talk to this woman. This stuff is great. It just fits so perfectly into the book, the stuff that was channeled from this owl. She basically said, I was walking down this path and I used to see this owl every day on the path. And then one day I finally said, you know, good, hello, owl. And then she had this telepathic conversation with this owl that she transcribed and put in the book. And I was talking to her on the phone. I'm so glad I recorded this. And I said, listen, I'm really confused. And I was sort of in the throes of the mixed up chapter of my life at that point. And I'll say that writing this book has calmed me down a lot. So there I'm talking to this woman, she's channeled an owl and stuff. And I said, listen, the next time you see that owl, like you ask for me, you ask it, what is going on with these UFOs and why are UFOs and owls somehow associated? And she answers me and she starts kind of talking a little haunted, kind of haltingly. And then the cadence of her voice changes. And she actually just kind of under her breath, she goes, words, words, as if like words weren't enough. And then she basically says, the owls are here to announce initiation. And she says, she gives the cleanest definition of an archetype, like this two-sentence definition of what an archetype might mean.
That's really interesting.
We are tapped in to owls at a subconscious level, and this is in our consciousness. It's part of our collective consciousness that owls have a particular meaning, and when owls show up, we are perceiving them not on a conscious level, but on a subconscious level with a deeper meaning. And it's when she said that, it was like a bell, just a little alarm bell went off in my head, and every single part of my research just clicked into place. Every disparate thing just like fell into place, and everything seemed so neat and tidy. If you look at owls as an archetype, they're performing an archetypal role. We have a subconscious knowledge of what an owl means, what an owl should be. And we see them consciously, right? It's just a bird with big eyes, and they're out there. But when they show up at the appropriate moment, they trigger something within our subconscious, and that was the cleanest definition I have. So if there is any summation, is that they are playing the archetypal role, and I'll say that they're playing the same archetypal role that they've played throughout the ages. The stories in this book, most of them are all present day stories told to me in first person or collected out of a modern text. These are the same stories that fill, books of mythology and folklore about owls. They're happening right now, really, just in a different context.
I'm happy you gave us that story, because now it makes even more sense, or something makes sense, is that they are maybe guardians of initiation or signposts of initiation. And that's why they may show up with the UFO, because of course, anyone who's had abduction or contact, it's an initiation. Your reality is shifted no matter what you remember or know. They are initiations of sorts, the UFO contact experience.
Well, and your story too, it fits cleanly with that. You have this, visionary dream of the underworld while sleeping in a round structure, a traditional round structure. Yes. Walk out under the night, under the night sky, and then you have an owl there to announce initiation. Sure.
Yeah, it's. I guess it goes back to the Campbell thing. We are all the we're all open to, we're all the hero with a thousand faces. Each of us really are moving through this world, but it's a symbolic world of mythic form, and we've been dulled by our culture and media to think that it's not. But if we were to really live in touch with nature, we would see these mythic archetypal elements all around us, and I think that's what your book is doing, is showing us that we are part of this bigger fabric of nature that's interacting with our psyche, and we have to pay attention to it. We have to, recognize we're part of this bigger nature, but nature is also a part of us. And
I agree. And I think, people who are separated from nature can still see owl t-shirts and see an owl on a TV commercial at just the right appropriate moment. And yeah, so it doesn't, I think you can step out of the forest and still have these powerful experiences.
That's true. But seeing an owl was so shocking to me. I didn't even know what it was. I couldn't cognize it, because I had never recognized it at first. I mean, it hit me after, but I could not. It was truly shocking. It's like, what is that thing?
I agree, yeah.
And to see it flying off in the night sky, silhouetted, I can still remember it. It was the strangest vision. I mean, one of the strangest things I've ever, even more than my UFO type experiences, because here I was really awake. I was conscious. Yes, maybe it was a screen memory, but I was really conscious of what I was, of seeing something. So, well, I think your book just helps us open our eyes more to the world that we're actually a part of.
Well, thank you so much. That wasn't what I set out to do, but it's. I feel like I tapped into that questioning.
What did you actually set out to do when you were writing? What did you set out to do?
Honestly, I just wanted to. I kind of wanted to. I recognized there was this pattern, right? I'd read a bunch of UFO books. I recognized the pattern of UFOs and owls, and I was kind of like, let me explore this, right? At first, I thought it was just going to be a magazine-length article, and I wrote that, and that's on my website, and that's 38 pages, and this is 390 pages, so it's basically that initial article multiplied by 10. At first, I thought it was just going to be a magazine-length essay, and then as soon as I finished the essay, I realized, like, holy crap, this is a bottomless pit, and I started pulling on this thread. I got to finish pulling on it.
Hello.
Oh, you there?
Oh, I lost you for a second.
Oh, okay.
To do what you said?
Oh, I'm not sure where I dropped out, but So I just I started doing the research and I realized, like, I have to pull on this thread, I started pulling on it and I realized there was a wealth of material there, and I just kept on. I just moved forward until I felt like it was completed. And in a way, it's not completed because I'm working on a second book.
Wow. Well, it's really, really exciting. I mean, thank you for doing this, because when I saw Richard Dolan, a month or so ago, he had a copy of this. It just looked like I knew I really wanted to get to read this. And
and I tried to make it readable. Like it might be a long book, but it reads pretty, it kind of zips along, and I worked hard to make it it's not dense.
You're a good writer. I can tell you're not just telling stories. You're actually a writer. A lot of people in the UFO field, they have to say, except for Whitley, who's a real writer.
Yeah. Well, I'm a real illustrator. Stories, so that's funny. Yeah. So, I mean, I worked as an illustrator first and then sort of took up writing. And I kind of long for drawing again, because that was, in some ways, it was easier, because you didn't have to, you could just kind of scribble and kind of make it work. And here you really have to be formal, when you do the writing.
But I can tell you put your effort into creating, into writing, into most people don't. But also, just like one more question: when was your last UFO experience? Are you still having sort of contact?
Well, my partner Andrea and I live in this, you know, up in upstate New York, and you know, weird stuff continues to happen. Yeah, so
like, you what? Know, if you don't mind sharing like one little weird thing.
Well, one thing is in the book, which is pretty tidy, where we both saw an owl in the front yard, right? So there's an owl in the driveway. She says, Mike, there's an owl. Come on, get out here. And so I grab my camera and I run out there. So I'm taking pictures of this owl on this branch. And as I'm taking pictures of it, Andrea's very intuitive. And she suddenly starts going, oh, no, there's something weird's going on. Uh-oh. I'm taking pictures. I'm taller than she is, so I'm standing right above her head, right in the exact line. She just starts describing, like, things are getting weird, and everything turned purple for her, and the owl itself was kind of in a kind of a halo of glowing magenta. And she's saying this real time, and I'm seeing nothing, and the photos are of a normal owl. And that, you know, it just kind of went away. A couple things happened. I went in the house, and I was... like within minutes of me getting in the house after the owl flew off, I was trying to get a hold of a fellow named Sequoia Trueblood, who's a shaman who was
in John Mack's book.
Yeah. And I've been trying to, cause he says John Mack quotes him, and I wanted to say like, whoa, is John accurate? Did you really say that? Basically he said that every shaman has had a UFO experience. A UFO contact experience. And when I spoke to him, that's what John Mack said. And he said, well, that's true, but he kind of softened it up a little bit, where he basically said every shaman can access the realms of the UFO contact experience. So, you know, but that was great. So I saw an owl within minutes. I'm talking to a shaman. And then afterwards, there was such a long string of synchronicity surrounding that owl event. It was just everything, the conversation we're having at the moment, the book that she was on a phone talking to a friend about a book, a specific chapter in a specific book, when she saw the owl and she went in and looked up that chapter of that book, and it was perfect.
It's so weird
for her right then.
I just want to say the book, Passport to the Cosmos, is like sitting right in front of me. I'm writing my own book, and I was doing some research in that book, and it's like this whole conversation that we're having, my computer's been sitting on that book, you know, Passport to the Cosmos. So,
and that's a great book. And that book is, man, I reference that book up one side and down the other in this thing, because there's owl stuff in there and the shaman thing in there. And that book's, you know, 20 years old.
But that's the synchronicity in the story. And I'm like right here with this book, and it's a strange world. But no recent UFO experiences, anything like that?
Not in the last, let me just think, UFOs. Oh, yeah. Not really, no.
Okay. I'm just
little
curious.
Lights in the room. We're getting little lights in our room. We call them sparkles. Okay. They're always in the same corner. These funny little sparkles show up in our room.
Right. Well, let's at some point talk again. When do you expect your next book out?
Geez, I wish I could say soon. It's coming along at a glacial speed, this book, but I'm very proud of how it's turning out. I wish I could say it would be done in the next few months, but I bet you it's going to be a little over that. Right. So within the next 6 months. By springtime or summer, it should be out.
Is Richard going to publish that too?
Oh, yeah. He's very eager to publish the follow-up book, yeah.
Great. Well, he's a great guy. He's probably one of the finest researchers out there.
Yeah, he's been a delight to work with. And he's a very strong promoter of this book. And I sense it's not an act. I think he really believes in this book.
Yes, definitely. So what's your website for people to get in touch with you?
There's a few. I've got one that's mikeclelland.com, just my name.com. And you can go there and then find links to the book and links to my blog. Most of my stuff is on my blog. I did for a long time. I for about 6 years, I did a podcast series. And those is, I got like well over 200 hours of podcasts on my blog. My blog is hiddenexperience.blogspot.com. You can just Google my name, or you can just Google UFOs.
And that's about, are you talking to abductees in that?
Most of the research is focused around abduction. There's a few other, but yeah, most of it is around abduction. And so I'm either talking to people who've had the direct experience or researchers. I interviewed Whitley I didn't interview Bud. Bud had passed. I worked with Bud when I was living, I was too embarrassed to actually, that's not true. I did interview him, but it was never for the podcast series. So. Oh,
great. These are really the pioneers. These, the work of John, Bud, Whitley, they should be national heroes because they have really stepped out in a way that,
that's what I'm doing is easy. Cause I mean, they paved their way, you know?
Yeah, but I wonder if there will come a day that, those realities will be recognized as,
well, I think there will come a day, but I bet you it does not happen from a guy on a podium declaring some truth from on high. I bet you it happens from the ground roots up or the grassroots up.
It could. Anyway, let's be in touch. I'll text your number. You can always call me if you want to follow up.
Great,
on my
that's awesome. Screen. Yeah, and I get down to the city every once in a while. It'd be great to have. We had in 2008. I think we ate at Cafe Kabul on St. Mark's.
Oh, we did.
There was a bunch of people at the table, but I was there. You and I.
How did I meet you there? How was that?
That was right at the time that Jeremy Vaney was having his conference in Jersey City back in 2008.
Oh, with Jeremy. Oh, are you in touch with Jeremy?
I haven't talked to him in ages. He's in Hawaii, last I heard.
But he's doing an interview show, you know, on Unknown.
He's
Country.
Doing it, which is an excellent show. He does it on Whitley Strieber's site. Yeah.
Yeah, he should interview you about this book. Actually.
You should tell him. Yeah, bring that up to him.
Well, drop him a line, or if I talk to him, yeah. Jeremy is great. He put together a couple of really good shows and art shows. What was that called?
Culture of Contact.
Culture of Contact. Yes, I was involved with both of them. The one in New York.
And the other in Jersey City, yeah. That's where we met, in Jersey City.
Oh, okay. Now I know. Okay. I was wondering how we knew each other. Thanks for
I was very brief. We met, and then there was a handful of people back in the city a few days later. So there was a bunch of people at the table in Cafe Kabul on St. Mark's. I'm pretty sure that's where we had lunch together.
Yeah, maybe it was something, or because I live right near there.
Yeah.
But maybe I'll see you at Contact in the Desert. I'm there. I also helped. Did you see The Hidden Hand? Did you see that movie?
Oh, sure. I'm friends with James Carman. I interviewed him in my podcast series. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's a good friend of mine.
Oh, great guy. Yeah.
There's a lot of great people in this field. So thanks, Mike, for being out there.
Thanks so much.
Okay. So be in touch. I'll text you my number on Facebook and we'll stay in contact.
Yeah. I'll do a formal interview and I'll treat you like a witness and then do a little more formal. It's just a little like,
I'd love that.
Interview like this, and an interview, radio interview like this. So
yeah, we'll do that. Great. So you say your name Cleland, right?
It's actually Cleland.
Cleland. Okay. I've been talking to Mike Cleland, the author of Messengers, Owl Synchronicities, and the UFO Abductee, published by Richard Dolan Press, forward by Richard Dolan. Great book. I mean, if you're interested in the whole phenomena, UFO synchronicity, this is a book to read. And there's some, I think that's a powerful underlying message, Mike, there, that is about being connected to a larger reality. And that's what comes through to me. So thank you. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and if you want to reach me, go to my website, newrealities.com, and my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/newrealities. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week. Good night.